One of the ways that I like to meet with groups is to meet you in the experience that we all share, which is an experience that an ongoing experience that we really don't know what's going to happen. And I could have prepared a very thorough discourse, but it's not so much my style. I like to just kind of jump off the cliff and see what happens so that we're all in it together, just discovering what unfolds in our life and see if we can find our composure with not knowing. And I did have some stray thoughts today about what I would speak about tonight, and I thought that it would be on the theme of loving the house that ego built, which was the title of the weekend. But then Ellen introduced me and reminded me of Upandita 1989, and then the wheels started turning. So I thought that I would talk a little bit about the topic of loving the house that ego built somewhat in the context of my time with Upandita Sayadaw. Those of you who've never heard of Upandita Sayadaw, he is a Burmese meditation master, and he was considered the successor to a very famous meditation master named Mahasi Sayadaw, or Sayadaw. Sayadaw is kind of the master teacher. Mahasi Sayadaw had the distinction of radically changing the way that the teachings of the Buddha were disseminated in such a way that they became much more accessible to lay people, less monastic, much more hopeful in a way that anyone taking a certain period of time out of one's life could discover the fruits of the teachings without necessarily having to live a monastic life. And so he was very instrumental in turning on a lot of Westerners, because many of his people who were influenced by him became the teachers in the West. He also had the distinction of one day having his attention drift from his nostrils, where he had been taught to pay attention to the breath as the primary anchor, very much part of the original sutra called the Anapanasati Sutta, which is mindfulness of breathing, and very often focalized in the tip of the nostrils. And Mahasi Sayadaw, Upandita's teacher, happened to be meditating one day and having a little bit difficult time feeling his breath at the nostrils. Have you ever had that experience where it's kind of faint and you can't feel it? Well, his attention drifted down to his belly, and lo and behold, he felt the sensations of breathing very distinctly, the much more gross sensation, and it started a whole movement of mindfulness of the rise and fall of the belly. How many of you use the rise and fall of the belly as your primary anchor? You have Upandita Sayadaw, really, to thank about that. Well, his successor, Upandita, different character completely, and considered a master of concentration and metta, loving kindness. And some would say that he was a master of what's called, this one person named Corrado Pensa called his mastery of Stone Age psychology, because he used this very unique way of sizing up a person's personality view, or their identity, their character, and then he would work it, and he did that I think with most everyone he worked with, and he did it with me to the point where for a while it worked, but after a while it didn't work. But I'll tell you a little bit about what happened. As you notice as you sit here tonight, and you just feel yourself sitting here. You experience your, you may feel the sensations of your rear on the cushion, you may feel a mood, you may just be hearing these words. But you're here in this room, each of you uniquely expressing life the way you do. And you're not so much, hopefully, not so much referring to the past, and you're not so much referring to the future. You're just here. And there's an we all have this capacity to experience ourselves intimately and directly. And when we do that, there's really not much going on in the immediate, simple unfolding of our experience. In some ways, as the Buddha suggested, there are just six things happening. There is seeing, there's hearing, there's smelling, there's tasting, there's sensing into the body, and there's thinking. That's it. When we're in touch with that simplicity, which is really reality, we begin to see that anything, any embellishment of that is secondhand. It's extra. So most of whatever profound drama has been playing in your mind, which is wonderful that dramas can play in our mind, that we can think of the past and the future, but whatever that is a secondhand version. It's kind of one step removed from reality. Well, Upandita was a master at helping meditators who worked with him, even though stylistically it was challenging and personality-wise it was challenging. He was marvelous at helping the yogis, as he whenever I'd walk into the interview, he'd say, "Yogi?" like this. And that was usually a setup, actually. I'll tell you more about that as we go along. But he was a master at allowing us to see the difference between just the suchness of what's happening, the bare reality, and the invitation as you worked with him when you practiced through the day intensively. We actually kept notebooks. How many of you sat with Upandita? Anybody here? Company of two. We had little notebooks, and we would sit literally 18 hours a day, sitting, walking, and the key was to report exactly what happened, whether you noticed it and what happened to it when you noticed it. Very simple, called no-frills dharma. Just simple, bare reality. And in doing that, it became much clearer the difference between just what happened and the embellishments that our mind makes. So I wonder if you noticed tonight, even thus far, if you noticed that you've added anything to the fact that you've had these six experiences repeating themselves all night. Did you add a narrative about what it's like to be here and how what it reminds you of and whether he seems okay or not, or whether you seem okay or not, whether you fit in, whether you sit in the back, whether you sit in the front, all the little dramas that the house of self creates, that our mind creates. Any of you see that difference between just what's happening? That's why I was so thankful to just take a walk in the forest with you, just to feel what it's like in a forest, what it's like for those trees. They're just being trees. Nothing extra. And that's not to romanticize too much. There's a lot that goes on in the forest. You know, beings are killing and being killed and fearful. In fact, that same summer, I sat, actually the summer before, I was with Ellen at Insight Meditation Society. With Upandita, I was with him in the mountains of Arizona for 2 months doing a retreat in this Girl Scout camp in the middle of a pine forest, and my daily walking partner was a squirrel. And the squirrel and I became intimately connected through our fear. I could feel the fear of the squirrel. And I resonated with that fear that all of us, our organisms all carry. And then we had this beautiful connection around fear. Of course, there couldn't be any projection in that. Anyway. So Upandita really liked someone who could see the difference between the suchness of what's happening, the simplicity, and any embellishment. It's like, I don't know if you've heard the line from, I think it's John James Audubon, or I forgot the first name. It's said, he is said to have said, I've since been reminded it may, he may not have said this, but he said something to the effect of, if there's a difference between the bird and what the field guidebook says, believe the bird. So we so often in our lives miss our direct and immediate experience, our intrinsic beauty, in fact. Because to me, and when I sit with you and I look at you, I have the advantage of looking into your eyes. I can see your... I don't know what kind of situation you have in your life. I can't tell that. I can see a little bit the way life has shaped you. But to me, in your immediacy, you're all quite fantastic, beautiful, unique, just yourself. But I have a strong feeling that what I see and the version of you that plays in your mind are quite different. And most of the time we are going to the field guidebook, which is that version that plays in our mind for as evidence for who we are, and often missing our natural goodness, our beauty, our okayness even, in spite of our situations. This is what the promise of meditation practice is. It helps us to step out of that stream of distress that is the story of me that plays through our mind, and allows us to be able to notice that, whoa, a thought of myself is not myself. It's an idea. So Upandita really liked that capacity to be able to see the difference between just what's happening. So you can practice that tonight as you sit here. Just notice what you are, who you are, what your experience is after your last idea about yourself has passed and before the next one comes. Notice what it's like. Notice how life is when we are in touch with reality. Not the reality of our situation. I mean, just immediate reality. I have a feeling if you do this enough, you will find a sense of home in this very life, in this very room. You may find that sense of composure that you thought, perhaps. Of course, our mind will tell us it can't be tonight. It's got to be after I sit the weekend at least, or 1,000 retreats. It can't be now. And that's what our minds do. Everything is about postponement. Everything is about the obsession with what's next. And our practice reminds us that we can just settle back. And interestingly enough, if I can practice that level of simplicity, if I can live that way, rather than becoming this blob of immediacy, this kind of blank nothing, I'm actually much more efficient, much more functional, I can deal with my to-do list much better than carrying it in my mind, burdening me all day. I can just do as much as I'm able to, one thing at a time. That's all I can do anyway. The past moment's gone. The next one hasn't happened. This is all there is. So Upandita liked that level of simplicity. And he could see the way that each of us in our unique way embellished our experience, living much more in the narrative that plays in our mind than what's happening right now. So I reached a point in one practice period with Upandita where I was seeing a lot, because I was 18 hours a day of paying really precise attention, really 20 hours a day. I was on about a 4 hour and 4 hour and 15 minute sleep schedule. And I was on fire. I just wanted to see everything as minutely as I could, as carefully as I could. And I was a little bit full of myself as being, you know, a kamikaze yogi. And I was starting to see some of what the Buddha talked about. And as most of you probably, whether you've read or you've practiced, you know that he began his teaching not with the good news about how we have this great capacity for awakening. He talked about how stressful life is for anyone who's born. That for anyone who's born, there are basically three kinds of suffering that continue pretty much unabated in the course of everyone's life, of what he called dukkha-dukkha, which is the garden variety, the birth, sickness, old age, death, lamentation, not getting what you want, not wanting what you get, all the loss, all the frustrated desire, all the wounded pride, dukkha-dukkha. Dukkha is the word for stress, unsatisfactoriness, that which is difficult to bear. Talked about anicca dukkha, the suffering, the stress of continual change, of everything that arising, passing away, the relentlessness of change. And then he talked about a third kind of stress that everyone faces, which is what he called sankhara or sankhara dukkha, which is the suffering of conditionality, of conditions, just the relentlessness of being moved by the conditions of our mind and body, moved by our life, buffeted by things out of our control. And how when we're really open and sensitive, we can feel that literally as an impingement on our organism. It's difficult just to bear the constant sights and sounds and smells and tastes and in a more gross way, the demands of our life, the getting up and doing it again, the shopping, the cooking, the cleaning, the working, everything. It's not all it's cracked up to be. It's not so easy. And this was the diagnosis, and then the prescription he offered was to welcome this, to open to it. Because if you don't open to this, your life is an endless running, an endless searching for pleasure and an avoidance of this. But that open secret is that the cure, as Rumi put it, the cure for pain is in the pain. We open to it. We find our composure in it. And our minds can relax. We don't have to be in a constant state of running. So in the middle of this long practice period, I am certain and in some ways gleeful to be experiencing what I thought was the height of sankhara dukkha. I had been doing, besides doing my walking with this lovely little squirrel in the forest, I also walked when I needed company. I walked with some of my Dharma friends on a tennis court that had ceased to be a tennis court, and now it was just a place where people did walking practice. And surrounding the tennis court was a stand of beautiful ponderosa pines. And up to this point in the retreat, about a month into the retreat, up to this point, those trees offered the most glorious sound, the wind blowing through a ponderosa pine. Have any of you ever, you know that sound? It's just, it's magnificent. But at this point in the retreat, that sound to these sense doors, these doors of perception, that sound was deafening. And it was almost unbearable. And in the same time, my skin felt as though everything was on fire, and my body felt heavy, and I knew that I was really experiencing dukkha. This is it. And I didn't realize this, but I was a bit excited to go to my next interview to tell Upandita Sayada about my experience of Sankara Dukkha. So I went into my interview, and you have to understand, not only is he listening for embellishments, but he's also playing the psychological game. So what he would do with me, and what he did with me when I first started to work with him, is he saw that I was sincere and serious, and that I was okay. But he treated me like I was the greatest yogi who ever lived. Like I said, when I walked in, he would say, "Yogi," and he would smile, and he would just be so sweet to me. And I completely fell for it. At the point where he had me, my following interviews, when I went into the interview room, this was a sequence getting more and more, the pressure was building. He, rather than treat me as the greatest meditator of all time, he picked up a book. One time he picked up a book and started reading and just turned away. Then, as I reported, and reported in a way that I thought was very skillful and accurate, every word out of my mouth, he almost as though he spit it right back at me. And I noticed in that treatment that the view that I had of myself just collapsed, crumbled in the face of his indifference and his opposition. I didn't want to feel that crumbling. And so what we often do, because all of our identity views, our personality views, our views of ourselves, that story that plays in our mind, it's all based on ideas. There's no solid ground there. It's quicksand. Because of that, I didn't want to feel that level of vulnerability. So instead, I spent the time in between interviews planning my revenge. This is what we do. This is the innocent attempt to keep ourselves together, to put ourselves back on firm ground. But of course, that doesn't help either. That just creates another kind of dependence, which is, you know, of course, all of it is what might be described as self-abandoning. We've completely left I've left myself, and I'm fixated on the object of my aversion, the Upandita Sayada, and then my well-being is completely dependent on whether I get him or not. And I did a few of my colleagues, friends, who happened to be at the time sitting in on my interviews, were certain during one of my next interviews that I was going to haul off and hit him. But I didn't. I'm collapsing a lot of different interviews together here to hopefully make some point that may be useful. Because when I went in to report about my experience of the pain of existence, being in touch with that, I know there are many horrible, terrible pain. This is, in some way, to have this occur on a meditation retreat is a kind of, it's a kind of bourgeois suffering, really, in a way. It's different than some of the really hard stuff that we go through in our lives. But nevertheless, it was a certain kind of measure of knowing and noticing that that had a huge impact on my being. So I went in to talk to Upandita, and I started to report, and I reported all my, how it was, I was dragging this body along, and everything that it was hurting, and everything was painful, and I was having insight into this. And he rolled his eyes and just listened to what I had to say. But as I was leaving my interview, his parting words to me were, just see dukkha as dukkha. Just see dukkha as dukkha. And that may not seem like a big deal to you as you hear this now, but to me, it cut right through the massive embellishment that I had built about dukkha, about myself and dukkha. It became all about me. It became all about my insight. And that became the beginning, in some way, of a lifelong process of taking an interest in noticing that process of how, moment by moment, those six experiences spawn this imaginary version of myself. A person who really doesn't even exist, a secondhand version of me that plays in my mind, and how when I misidentify with that psychological version or take that to be an absolute fact, I'm literally spinning in quicksand. And yet, being able to regard that play that all of us do in our mind, all of our personality stories, all of our tendencies of mind to put ourselves above. Any of you ever do that? Put yourself below? Put yourself equal to? Compare? Judge? Someone was telling me, just to remind us that this is so universal, this personality view, the Buddha called Sakaya Ditti. It's just so much a part of every person's stream of mind or life experience. Someone reminded me that because a lot of our personality view, a lot of our story is a story about somebody who's not quite getting it, not quite doing well enough, not quite enough. Any of you ever have that? Something wrong? Isn't that the narrative? There's some conflict, and we're somehow the protagonist in this conflict, and we have some kind of antagonist, whether it's a person or the career or the situation. But this is the story, and it's always about somebody who's not doing so great. That person really doesn't exist. That's just the imaginary version. The one, that doesn't mean that you don't exist. You're all here. But I imagine you also dwell a lot of the time in that other kind of version of yourself. But someone was telling me, and I think it really made sense why a lot of that narrative, a lot of that view of self that goes on is attempting to improve or be better or get caught up in what the Buddha called mana or pride. The person told me that there was a study done, maybe some of you have read this or heard about it, there was a study done where people were asked what they value in other people and what they value in themselves. And universally, what people valued in other people was their warmth, their goodness, their integrity, intrinsic values. I can see that when I look around this room. I can almost tell this kind of purity. And we see that in other people and we love them. We don't even care what they do. But what we value in ourselves, this is the study also said, what we value in ourselves is competence. We often undervalue what is really beautiful enough and valuable in ourselves, intrinsically, without any kind of measurement. Sometime over the weekend, for those of you who are sitting, I'll share this poem from Rumi that I don't have it with me, but it's entitled Tending Two Shops, and there's one line in there where he says, live in the nowhere where you came from, even though you have an address here. You have eyes that see from that nowhere, and you have eyes that judge distances, how high, how low. He says, you own two shops and you run back and forth. He says, try to close the one that's a fearful trap, always measuring, checkmate this way, checkmate that. Keep open the shop where you're not selling fish hooks anymore, where you're the free swimming fish. So implicit in this is that the Dharma wants us to value ourselves just as we are. Doesn't mean that we can't all use some improvement, but the invitation is to not for one moment overlook what's sometimes called the open secret, that you are in your present state, your present sense of immediacy, you are exactly what it is that you're looking for at the end of the rainbow. That you do not have to lift out of this moment to find that. And the house that ego built will tell us will continually tell us that there's something that's not quite enough about us and that we need to go out of ourselves in search. That's why it's such a pleasure to sit in the forest with you and just let ourselves be for once. And then to do it not just once, but all the time. And see whether or not you lose anything in your functioning, in your competence even. In fact, I think we're more competent if we trust ourselves a little more, let ourselves be. So having seen with Upandita that what felt a little bit almost embarrassing, how far, how much I had built the house of myself around this beautiful, painful Dharma principle, how much I had embellished this sense of me around this experience. Having seen that, I was a little bit, it kind of cascaded, it got into a lot of papancha. You've heard that word papancha, a kind of complication, proliferation. Just started thinking a lot about it. And my tendency was, and I don't know if this is true about you, but my tendency was to begin to judge myself and then to judge my judging, and then for the judging mind would just compound until I beat myself to a pulp because I didn't measure up to some. Then at that point it was now the ideal of the great meditator, another trap. Now I have to forgive myself a little bit because I was in my 20s and during a lot of this, and just so full of, just full of myself, that's all I can say. But I saw that this sense of personalizing, this sense of making everything about me, you know, I started to see it everywhere on retreat, especially on retreats. You know, somebody would come into the room late and make a lot of noise, and that was about me. I was mad. Or person next to me breathing. It could be any number of things. It's all about me. I started to see how much I selfed. I call it me-ing and my-ing, all selfing over and over. How much I would posture and get inflated if somebody praised me, and how deflated if somebody blamed me. Just ego everywhere. And then it dawned on me one day, based on what Upandita had said in that interview, just see dukkha as dukkha. And what came to my mind was, just see ego as ego. Just see selfing as selfing. So the beauty of practice is not what it does to delete, suppress, quiet this narrative, this personality view that plays in our mind, but to allow a space, to allow a capacity to regard that with kindness, with mercy, with acceptance, all fulfilled by simply being aware of ego as ego, just another appearance in our mind. There's sounds, there's smells, there's tastes, there's sensations, and there's ego. And it's just another one of our sense experiences. Nothing much, really. Nothing to make such a fuss about. Now, when I talk about it this way, it may sound as though I don't appreciate how painful it is to land in some kind of view about ourselves, especially what the Buddha called amana, when we put ourselves down, less than. It's so amazing how you can walk into a room of people and you hear someone say something quite wonderful, and all of a sudden, within an instant, I had been just in a perfectly even, balanced state of mind, and within one moment, I'm all of a sudden feeling not so good about myself. You ever have that experience? And the more we practice, this may be the bad news. It's both good news and bad news. I'll tell you why. The more you practice, the more you see the difference between how marvelous it is, how wonderful each of us is when we let ourselves be and we're undefined, just being ourselves. And the more one gets used to that, the more painful it is when we incarnate, when we become so small again in one of those little contractions, one of those little views. And that the difference between those gets bigger and bigger. On the other hand, because that meing and mying, that selfing, becomes more painful, it becomes much more, I hope this makes sense, this becomes much more the cause of kindness and mercy, caring. So we realize how much we're suffering. And the encouragement of our practice is to have our hearts break for ourselves, to open up that tenderness that we so much appreciate in everyone else, but then we hide ourselves away in this kind of hardness and perfectionism and this intense internal demand to be special, to become special instead of recognizing our natural specialness. I brought, I think I have with me. Let's see if I got lucky. This is a poem about the way that our mind compares not just to another person and puts ourselves above, below, or equal to, but to an ideal. And I think it's a lot of ideals, and we're influenced so much by cultural ideals and even spiritual ideals, and how it's so easy to build a case for the prosecution against ourselves. This is called Inner Strength. I don't know who the author is, but it's widely circulated, so pardon me if you've heard it before. If you can start the day without caffeine or other stimulants, if you can be cheerful, ignoring aches and pains, if you can resist complaining and boring people with your troubles, if you can eat the same food every day and be grateful for it, if you can understand when loved ones are too busy to give you time, if you can overlook when people take things out on you, when through no fault of yours something goes wrong, if you can take criticism and blame without resentment, if you can face the world without lies and deceit, if you can conquer tension without medical help, if you can relax without alcohol, if you can sleep without the aid of drugs, if you can do all those things, these things, then you are probably the family dog. You were inspired there for a few minutes, weren't you? There's nothing wrong with being inspired, but give yourself a break. I was thinking this afternoon about this fellow named Dave, I think his name is David Roach. He started a church called the Church of 80% Sincerity. Because as soon as you join the church of 100%, you're in trouble. 80% wise, 80% kind, 80% mindful. He used to have a traveling show where he talked about his church and invited members, and has a book that he wrote, but I can't remember the exact title. But I highly recommend you read him. He was born with a very, very intense physical disfigurement and learned how to find joy being just who he is. The beautiful thing about teachings like David Roach's, the teachings of the Buddha, is it reminds us that we are not stuck being the way we are. We are each an open, creative field of possibility. And it seems, and I can speak from my own experience, that if what gets dropped, what seed gets dropped into the field of creative possibilities, which is just every moment, what gets dropped into that field is the seed of attention, that art of making space for what's there, the seed of goodwill, the seed of the intention to be kind and non-harming, that if you plant that seed, then it really is possible in the span of our life to truly to be able to meet the house that ego built, that quicksand-like edifice that drives us crazy, to meet it with kindness and have it actually be the cause of our compassion, cause of our sense of freedom. And really join us together in this human predicament. Not something we have to get rid of. We're all in this together. And it is possible, depending on what seeds we plant, to gain a profound confidence that that what it is that you long for so much in your life is, as it's said in the Bhagavad Gita, it's nearer than your breath. That you can, as Camus put it, in the midst of winter, you can realize that there is within you an invincible summer. And just start to notice what it's like after your last thought has passed and before the next one arises. That first-hand experience rather than the second-hand version of yourself. And you may discover something that's worth getting used to. It's not something you create. It's something that's already there. Some would say this is your Buddha nature, your true nature.